Excellent. Then we'll proceed with the last case of the calendar this morning, A23-1358, in the matter of the welfare of the children of VRR and MAH. Are all counsel familiar with the court's Zoom platform and the procedures that we'll be using this morning?
Yes, Your Honor.
Yes, Your Honor.
Excellent. Then I ask each of you to state your name before each leg of your argument so we have identification for the audio recording that's made available to the public. And before beginning, could respondents' counsel confirm that you're going to split your allotted 15-minute argument time equally between the two of you?
Yes, Your Honor.
That is correct.
Very good. Then counsel for appellant may introduce himself for the record and present argument.
Thank you, Your Honor. Paul Hunt on behalf of the appellant, Judith Flores. Good morning, honorable judges, opposing counsel. May it please the court. As I stated, I represent Judith Flores in this matter. This matter is somewhat of a unique matter as it comes before the court related to a juvenile protection proceeding post-permanency. The issue before the court, Your Honors, is whether or not the district court abused its discretion in denying the appellant's motion for adoptive placement of the minor child JJR. In accordance with, and her request was in accordance with Minnesota Statute 260C.607. Today, appellant asserts that the district court erred in its denial of appellant's requests for adoptive placement of JJR and requests a reversal of the district court's order or remand for further proceedings. The facts of this case, Your Honors, are fairly unique in nature. As I stated, the present case involves a juvenile protection proceeding related to essentially three children, but in this case, only one child is the subject of this appeal. JJR is now age 5 years old. He's been subject to out-of-home placement since approximately December of 2018. He was placed with the appellant in November of 2018, along with his sibling, his older sibling, JJHR, and eventually his other sibling, JJR, who is younger than he is. Appellant is the biological grandmother.
And counsel, I think we're familiar with the record. I mean, suffice it to say that when the incidents of December 2021 occurred and came to the county's attention, that placement that had been for almost 3 years at that point disrupted. And so here we are. The district court, followed the statute. And it seems to me the critical issue for you is best interests. Why should we conclude that the district court abused its discretion in determining that placing the child with your client for adoption would not be in the child's best interest? Why is that abuse of discretion?
Your Honor, in looking at the record in whole, as a whole and the totality of the circumstances and considering the overarching purpose of the state of Minnesota, which is to uphold the best interests of the children, as the court is well aware, but also to keep families together. Pursuant to the statute 260C.607, as stated, my client did request an evidentiary hearing and requested that adoptive placement occur. The court has two obligations effectively in that matter to determine whether or not the county was unreasonable in not placing the minor child, and then two, essentially assessing that if finding that the court or that the county or the respondent agency was unreasonable, then it has to determine whether or not it is in the best interest of the child to be placed with the appellant or the moving party.
Right. And again, we know right. that your client, met that first hurdle, the proof right. after the evidentiary hearing that the agency had been unreasonable in failing to basically return the child to her custody. Right. Why would we go on to conclude, though, that the best interest finding is an abuse of discretion?
Your Honor, we believe that the record speaks for itself in that nature, in that what we have is a circumstance where siblings are being separated, which is against a major public policy issue. We have an issue where there's disputed evidence. There was an ample amount of evidence in the record that suggested that my client's home was an appropriate place for the siblings to be placed. There was even expert testimony that was conclusory in nature that contradicted itself at the trial. Furthermore, there was an ample amount of connection between my client and the minor child through supervised visitation records. The county had continued visitation between my client even after they determined on their own to not reconsider my client as an adoptive placement.
And in fact, that was important, I believe, to the district court, that the agency still to this day says we understand the importance of that grandparent-grandchild relationship, and that the foster parents with whom the child's been placed now for a year and a half intend to promote that relationship.
Right.
Am I right about that?
Yeah, the court did find that. And I think that's one of the major concerning issues here, Your Honor, is that there was no testimony from the foster parents or anybody that said that, other than essentially what was being represented by the very agency that had acted unreasonably, according to the district court, that would occur. In fact, the district court makes a statement in the court order that has really no legal significance or the ability to do. And that is, in its court order, it states that the court is going to give significant weight to the plan for the child to continue to have visitation and contact, whether there is a legally enforceable agreement regarding visitation and contact. There is no such thing. I don't know that there is any legal authority for the court to force a contact agreement. Those come by agreement only. And so the major concern is here, we have a separation of siblings. We have a family torn apart. I mean, what's really significant in this case, Your Honors, is that the very same agency made a determination that the older sibling that the home environment was safe for the older sibling to be returned within 2 months of the incident of December of 2021, just 2 months. And then effectively, systematically cut off even the sibling relationship and the relationship between the grandparents and the children. We believe that that was an error, and that there was ample amount of evidence to suggest that my client's home was perfectly capable of having the children placed with her. Now, there's argument about a maltreatment finding, and there's discussion about foster licensing. I would submit to the court that that is not the standard for a relative placement. It's a matter of having a home study, and it's a matter of the county or the agency conducting their statutory obligations to reconsider. At every time there was a move of these children to put them back with their siblings or to place them with my client, who is a relative. And
Mr. Hunt, what's the legal impact of the September 2022 order from DHS revoking your client's foster care license? What's the implication of that, or what implication does that have on the home study assessment update that your client obtained back in May of 2021? That if you look at just that assessment, had a 2 year period.
Right. So, Your Honor, at that point, I think you have to look at it from the time standpoint. You had an issue of the placement with the pre-adoptive parents has already been made in August of 2022. And prior to that, there had never been a reconsideration of my client, during which period she did have an effective home study. And so that's really what happens. There was a delay in the trial, and so understandably so, but the court has the ability to order after the evidentiary hearing, to order that the county or the agency work with my client to obtain a new home study. Through that home study process, Your Honor, then the home study agency is obligated to look at the effect of a maltreatment determination as it pertains to the best interest of the children. That simply never happened. And under the circumstances, this whole the statutory failure, the failures of the agency to follow the law is what is significantly concerning, and it has lifelong effects, not just on JJR, but on JJHF and JUR.
And yet the statute, I mean, I don't disagree with you, and it certainly seems there were procedural and other errors by the county in this case in terms of how they handle it. I don't disagree with you, and the court made a number of findings in that regard. But the statute at issue here, under which your client is seeking to become the adoptive parent of this child, you know, not only requires a finding that the county behaved unreasonably, but also that this placement is in the best interest. How does the county's failure to behave reasonably or conduct itself reasonably in terms of promoting a placement or at least exploring a placement after December 2021 with your client, how does that impact the best interest findings, if at all?
I think it does, Your Honor. My client's at a significant disadvantage. She was the original placement, if we recall, and has attachment and bond. That was all determined. That was all determined that the minor child has a bonded relationship with his grandparents and his sibling. And throughout this process, the statutory failures put my client at a significant disadvantage to even present anything about the current best interests of the child. The only evidence that was available based upon the systematic removal of my client from having contact with this child. If you look at the record, Your Honor, you can see that it was testified to by the social worker that they started to reduce visits to the point where my client was having little or no contact at the time of trial. And so, or at least it was supervised. So the record reflects that the supervised visits continued that relationship between Ms. Flores, my client, and the minor child. The child would cry. The child would be sad upon having to leave. That's what the records show. And the court effectively disregarded that evidence, which was significant. The experts themselves testified that if the child has a bonded relationship, the child could, it would be better to have the child go back with a person with whom they're bonded than move to a stranger. It appears that the court did not necessarily analyze the best interest factors appropriately in taking the totality of the circumstances and the great disadvantage of an individual who has had the children removed, and then the county never did, the agency, excuse me, never did an honest consideration looking at the best interests of the children. So then when the court gets it at the evidentiary hearing, the record is, there's nothing necessarily in the record for the court to review as it pertains to my client, other than, I believe, the overwhelming inference that my client's home was determined by the very same agency to be appropriate for the older sibling. But that was never considered by the agency. And the court basically, I believe, had to flip a coin. That's
well,
where
the older child was, I think, 6 years older than the child who was the subject of this particular event. And your client had already adopted that child, right? So it's a little bit of a different posture going into the analysis, isn't it? Doesn't that make a difference?
I would recognize that there is a different, maybe, legal standard for reunification, except that I don't necessarily think that that is true in light of 260C607. There is obviously an obligation to reunify, and then that was done after my client worked a case plan. But then subsequently, the county made a determination never to return that child, JJR, in approximately January of 2021, meanwhile returning the other child in February. And so what's concerning is the lack of the agency's looking at the public policy of this, that we try to keep families together. People are allowed to make mistakes. And my client, the appellant, recognized her mistake. She remedied the mistake. She followed a case plan, has maintained her sobriety, and has been fighting ever since to get these children back. And the unfortunate result of the actions of the county has created an almost impossible way to keep this family together. The legal standard for reunification, I get it. She had already adopted that child. She was in the process of adopting JJR when on December 15th, just basically the same day as the disruption, the agency discontinued the North Star application for adoption. They'd effectively made the determination that these children were never going to be together on that date, that these children were not going to be with each other and with my client at that point. They never looked back. And that's majorly, that is a major concern. And so getting back to Your Honor's question on the best interest factors, that has to count for something when we're looking at making a right from a wrong. We have these children here, and the analysis says it seems to be back and forth and essentially speculative based upon the fact that the agency violated statutory rights of my client and then utilized that those violations to get to gain a significant advantage by removing the children, the JJR, from the care of my client and never looking back. The evidence we believe is sufficient to warrant a reversal. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Unless there is an objection to order, let's hear next from counsel for respondent, Wadena County Human Services.
Yes, Your Honor. Thank you. May it please the court. My name is Brent Peterson. I'm an assistant Wadena County attorney, and I'm representing the respondent, Wadena County Human Services, in this case. In this case, the district court abused its discretion in finding that the county was unreasonable in not making the adaptive placement with appellant, but did not abuse its discretion in denying appellant's motion for adaptive placement. Accordingly, we are respectfully requesting that this court affirm the district court's order denying the appellant's motion for adaptive placement. As this court is aware, a review—
Counsel, let me ask you this. Given the fact that the statute, 260C.607, I don't remember what subdivision we are in, 6, requires a district court to make findings, presuming a grandparent who's seeking adoptive placement has made the other kind of preliminary showings, that they have to prove both that the county was unreasonable in taking steps to place that child with the grandparent and that the best interest of the child would not be served by placing the child with grandparent. Does it matter in terms of this court's analysis on appeal how the district court answered that first question, given the fact that if we agree with you, we would be affirming simply on the best interest prong?
Yes, Your Honor. I think it does matter because
why, the district— why isn't the error harmless, I guess, is my question.
Sure. Well, it's not harmless because as the court is aware, an abuse of discretion happens where there are findings of fact that are unsupported by the evidence, by misapplying the law, or delivering a decision that is against logic and fact and the records. In this case, the district court's findings that the county was unreasonable does have ramifications down the road, and I think it's setting bad precedent for future cases when the Court of Appeals or district courts look at the reasonable efforts by a county in a position like this. And I would say that it was an abuse of discretion. Because the record supports that the county was reasonable in considering appellant for adaptive placement.
Not Can only I press you on that for a second? I too share Judge Bjorkman's question. Is it necessary for us to even review the district court's decision regarding the reasonableness or lack thereof of the county's decision if in fact the best interest determination trumps? And you say, well, it has ramifications, but if it's a district court decision that wasn't considered and affirmed or rejected on appeal, how does it have ramifications? It's not binding on anyone.
Well, like I said, I think it sets bad precedent. District court orders can be cited.
District court orders can be cited all day long, but they're not binding on anyone. So I don't understand how it sets any precedent.
Well, it's not binding, but it can be used as persuasive authority. And I think in this case in particular, it's giving direction to the county, human services in particular. And if they're doing their statutory duties, which they are, It has ramifications outside of this as well. And again, like I said, I think that there was an abuse of discretion here, because not only did the county consider the appellant for adoptive placement, but the county did in fact place JJR with the appellant for adoption up until his removal was necessitated in December of 2021 due to these safety issues.
Well, I mean, that's the rub. I mean, it's that, that the county then never took any subsequent steps after December of 2021, notwithstanding the fact that with respect to grandmother's adopted, the siblings she had adopted, that in fact, the county let her work a case plan and they were able to reunify. So isn't it what the county did or didn't do after December of 2021 that's at issue here?
Well, yes, I would agree with that. But I think first off, the statute discusses consideration for adoptive placement. And I want to go back to the trial court's order granting this evidentiary hearing in the first place. I think the trial court's order was not entirely clear to all the parties, as the motion that was brought by appellant in the first case, in the first place, was really a subdivision 5 motion, which is distinct from subdivision 6. Subdivision 5, as the court is aware, is for consideration to be considered as an adoptive placement. Subdivision 6 is actually for adoptive placement. And I think the court's order granting the evidentiary hearing uses language from both subdivisions and essentially converted this from a subdivision 5 motion into a subdivision 6 motion. And getting back to your question, yes, it is important to look at what the county did after the child was removed from the home here. And as the court noted, JJHF was a fully adopted child of the appellant. So the county had different duties, reasonable efforts to reunify and work that case plan. At the time that JJR was removed from the home, he had been an out-of-home placement for an excess of 1,100 days. And the county had statutory duties to establish a permanent home for the child. And looking at what the county did after the child was removed, we have a number of things that the county was intimately involved in here. We had the maltreatment determination. We had the removal of JJR from the home. We had the removal of JJHF from the home as well. And JJHF was placed in the custody of the county following his removal until I think it was April of 2022 when custody was returned, subject to protective supervision.
Can I ask you that? Can I ask you this? A couple of questions, because I know you're almost out of time. First of all, what legal effect does the September 2022 license revocation order have on the home study assessment that was in effect through May of 2023 by its terms?
Yeah, well, I think the record shows that there's testimony from the licensor at Wadena County Human Services. The record reflects that even before the license revocation came through from DHS, once that letter was sent to DHS recommending the license revocation, that licensor testified that that home study assessment was no longer valid, because once that recommendation was made to DHS to revoke the license went from active to pending. So it started before September of 2022, but when September of 2022 came into effect, That placed a 5-year bar now on any licensing through DHS. So it did have a significant effect. Thank you.
Judge Larkin, may I please ask one more question?
I was nodding faster than I could click, of course.
Let's just assume for the purposes of this question that we disagree and find the district court did not abuse its discretion in concluding that the county did not make the required reasonable efforts to support adoptive placement with grandmother. How do you respond to the appellant's argument that abuse of discretion affects the best interest determination and whether the best interest findings are abuse of discretion?
Well, certainly I can address that. I think the appellant had a duty at the evidentiary hearing to present evidence on the best interest factors. The record reflects that the two expert witnesses who testified in this case were unrebutted. At no point did the appellant produce expert testimony to rebut that testimony, nor did the appellant call herself to testify as to what's in the best interest of the child. So I think the burden is on the appellant to produce that best interest evidence. And in this case, the appellant chose not to produce any evidence on that. Thank you.
Thank you. We'll now hear from counsel for the guardian ad litem again. State your name for the record before beginning your argument.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Angela Sonsala, and I represent respondent guardian ad litem. Your Honors, the guardian ad litem is asking the court to provide the following relief. First, that the district court's court's findings, regarding the best interests of the child be affirmed, and ultimately the court's denial of intervener or appellant's motion also be affirmed. However, the guardian ad litem does feel it's appropriate for this court to vacate several findings and conclusions of law of the trial court, specifically findings related to the county failing to consider the potential adoptive placements in the correct order, the finding regarding an honest consideration of intervener as a prospective adoptive placement never happened, and additionally findings located on page 37 through 38 of the court's order, paragraphs 100, 101, and 102. Obviously, my time here is very brief today, so I want to focus on two main points. Of course, the best interest of the child, but I think before getting into that, I want to focus on the fact that an evidentiary hearing in this matter was never warranted. And so I'm going to ask the court to consider determining that an evidentiary hearing was inappropriate, and I think that is then dispositive of the entire issue. In this case, as counsel for
wouldn't affirmance on the best interest determination also be dispositive, and why would we go beyond that if that's the only issue that the appellant challenges?
It is dispositive, Your Honor. I do agree with that, and I can certainly address those issues. I think the other issue is relevant too, but moving to the best interest factors, which was the second point I was intending to address. There were two experts that testified at trial, and the court made findings specifically regarding those experts. That was Ben Nesbitt, who is a licensed independent clinical social worker, as well as Dina McMahon, also a licensed independent clinical social worker. The district court correctly made findings that Mr. Nesbitt's testimony was extremely credible and persuasive. The court found that he was an expert in trauma, attachment, and adoption, that he directly observed the child engage in dissociative behaviors as a response to stress and anxiety when the child was talking about difficult things during Mr. Nesbitt's sessions with this child. Mr. Nesbitt goes on to opine, and the court found that the lack of a permanency has affected the child, that the child did not know what was going to happen to him, and he could not lower his anxiety until permanency was achieved. And emphatically, I would say that the court's finding that Mr. Nesbitt was, and I quote, terrified that an additional move for the child could cause irreparable damage and catastrophic damage to the child is a paramount finding. That goes directly to the best interests of the child. And of course, as the court is well aware, the best interest of the child is the paramount consideration.
Well, here I think we get to appellant's kind of the linkage between the county's failure to do what it is supposed to do in terms of try after December 21 to explore once again if grandmother is an appropriate adoptive placement. Because they didn't do that, then of course a new permanency, a new permanent situation was set up. And by the time this evidentiary hearing occurred, both JJR and his younger sibling had been with the new foster parents for over a year. So it wasn't sort of the expert's conclusions about the need for stability and the danger of moving these children again. I mean, wasn't it a foregone conclusion then that best interests would determination would come down in the opposite of what grandmother wanted?
Your Honor, to answer that, I would say that the duty of the court, of the trial court at the time of the evidentiary hearing is to consider the best interests of the child at that time. And I think that the law is clear, the best interest of the child at the time that the court is making the decision is the paramount consideration. And so speculating what may have happened or what could have happened had things gone differently a year and a half previously, I think is irrelevant to the court's consideration of best interest at the time of the evidentiary hearing. But I would like to say that I think that it's erroneous for the trial court to have determined that the county failed to reconsider the appellant. I would argue that the appellant was reconsidered on a continuous basis, but the reality is replacement of the child with the appellant was not even a legal option during the time that the appellant's foster care license was under investigation. And that foster care license was under investigation from the date of shortly after, within days after this December 11th, 12th, and 13th, 2021 incident. I believe that the foster care license came under investigation again within days, I believe on December 15th of 2021, all the way until the Minnesota DHS determination on or about September 9th of 2022. During that entire time, that child, that foster care license was under investigation. And that is a completely different standard when we're talking about returning the legal child of the appellant to the appellant's care versus returning a foster child to appellant's care. It's not at the point that it wasn't even a legal option. The county, I believe, considered it, but that consideration would be very brief. The county was well aware of this ongoing, as was the guardian ad litem, of this ongoing investigation. And until that investigation was concluded and the determination was made, it simply was not appropriate to replace the child, who's the interest of this case, in that home, nor would it have been in the child's best interest, because that could have certainly resulted in the child being essentially replaced with appellant and then very potentially removed again, because at that point there were significant concerns in appellant's home, and there was no way at that time, at that point in time, or at any point in time during this time period from December 2021 to September 2022, for the county or the guardian ad litem to feel confident that that would be a placement where the child would remain. And so to that, I guess I've answered your question, I hope, appropriately and fully, but in two separate ways. You know, first, that the court has to look at the time of the evidentiary hearing. And secondly, that I do believe that that was considered throughout the entirety of the case. I see I'm out of time. In effect, I've gone over. So I apologize for that. Thank you.
No need to apologize. Are there any additional questions by the panel members? Thank you. We'll now hear rebuttal argument. Again, state your name for the record before beginning.
Thank you, Paul Hunt, on behalf of the appellant. Much is being made about the foster license. I would note that there has never been cited any legal authority that states that an agency does not have the obligation to consider or reconsider a relative under 260C.607. As a matter of fact, as part of the record, we introduced DHS's own policies that stated that DHS or the agency had an obligation to reconsider a relative. At no time were they to stop without a court order. That court order was never obtained.
Is that true if there is no home study in effect because it's been suspended?
Again, there's never been any, at the time of the motion, there was a home study in effect. There's no evidence in the record that there's that cites to any authority by statute that there was not a capability of placing this party or placing this child back with my client and then helping her to obtain an updated home study. There's nothing in the statute. As a matter of fact, 260C.607 subdivision, I apologize, 6F, I'm sorry, subdivision 6 specifically distinguishes if the relative or the child's foster parent. So there's a distinction there. You don't have to be a foster parent under 260C.607. And the agency makes much ado about that when that is not the standard that needs to be looked at. Under the circumstances, I also want to address, Your Honor, the argument that there was no evidence presented. And I think the court asked a very pertinent question. When you look at it, the statute doesn't say at this time as it pertains to the best interest of the child. It's an overall review of 260C.212, subdivision 2, paragraph B, that the court is required to make an analysis. That's taking into account the totality of the circumstances. And there was evidence presented about the relationship between my client and JJR. There was evidence presented as pertains to the relationship between JJR and his siblings. And the concern is that the agency, by absolutely failing to follow the law, created this situation that there was no ability for my client to talk about what's in the best interest of the child because time had moved forward. And so now we have this situation where my client could get up there and speculate, but she was getting supervised visitations at the time. And what's there to say? She had been determined previously, prior to 2021, to be the most, to be the best option. There was evidence in the record that nobody could point to any problem other than what happened on December 10th through the 15th, or roughly in December of 2021. Subsequent there too.
But in fairness, that what was discovered in December of 2021 is that for a period of time, your client had struggled with chemical use and mental health issues, correct?
Absolutely, Your Honor.
Which she addressed to her credit and got a case plan. But I mean, to say that that was a one incident is not exactly true.
Right. I understand that, Your Honor. I'm looking at what was in the record of what the knowledge of the social workers who had been in my client's home on numerous occasions, because at that point, the children were still under the, they're under the guardianship of the commissioner. And so they had to do follow-ups. But you're right, Your Honor. There were some issues. We would concede that. The issue that stands, though, is that the overarching issue here is, doesn't the county have an obligation to continue to try to keep children together? And I think the answer is yes. This has a significant public policy effect in that the technical issue between my client being the adoptive parent of one of the siblings and then removing and never looking back by removing the other two siblings is that creates a terrible precedent, Your Honor. That is a significant issue. And the fact that the county agency is tasked with the best interests of the children, and yet the testimony was the agency never did a head-to-head review of the best interest factors subsequent as it pertains to the individualized determination for the minor children subsequent to December of 2021. Never. That was the testimony. Had that been done, we would have seen a remedied grandparent. We would have had the opportunity potentially to have the children placed back. Understanding that that's partially speculative and the district court even stated that, but that's the issue we have here. Putting my client at a distinct disadvantage because the county had all the power. They had all the control. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, everyone, for the arguments and briefing. The case is submitted. You'll have our decision in the expedited timeframe required by law. That concludes the court's Zoom hearings this morning. We are in recess.
Thank you. Your Honor.